Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here today. We're talking about physical therapy and zero in a little bit to start on digital rehabilitation programs or physical therapy online. Take a closer look at how telerehab works, and we'll get quizzed in honor of National Physical Therapy Month. Lori Tyne Brody, one of our guests, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Lori, good to have you back.
It is good to be here.
Jill Tyne Nissenbaum with us as well, an associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW. And Jill, good to see you too.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And of course, as you listen to these two experts, I hope you'll join in with your questions. Have you tried telerehab, for example? Do you prefer using the internet to stay on track with workouts? What general physical therapy questions do you have? Whatever, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Jill, you got a quiz for us today?
I have some physical therapy and physical therapist assistant trivia in honor of National Physical Therapy Month. October is always National Physical Therapy Month, and so we like to give recognition to our profession and our association. So the first question for you, Larry, is, and I'll give it to you multiple choice.
Okay.
How many members are there in the American Physical Therapy Association, which houses members who are physical therapists, physical therapist assistants, and students?
Ooh,
of those?
So students too.
Your choices are 100, 1,000, 10,000, or 100,000 across the United States.
Across the whole country. Oh, it's got to be the high number.
That's correct. Our association is 100,000 members strong. So you can be a physical therapist or physical therapist assistant and not belong to the association, but there are many benefits of belonging to your professional organization, as you probably know.
Yeah.
Most professions have those professional organizations. All right, next question. What year was the American Physical Therapy Association first founded? So how many years old do you think we are? Are we, again, I'll give you a ballpark. Are we 25 years old? Are we 50 years old? Are we 75 years old? Or are we 101 years old?
I don't think you're 100. You don't look 101 years old to me. I'm going to go with 50 years.
We are 101 years old.
Oh,
so yeah. You want to explain that a little bit, Lori?
Oh, must I?
Sure.
So
not that you remember that.
Yeah, exactly. So we started as restoration aids way back in the World Wars. So when people came back injured from war or service, they recognized the need for rehabilitative activities for these people. And so the first physical therapists and physical therapist assistants were actually called restoration aides.
And the association was actually called the American Women's Physical Therapeutic Association because it was predominantly women who were serving in that capacity.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Larry. Can someone go and see a physical therapist without seeing a physician or other health provider first? So, in other words, does a patient have to have a referral in order to see a physical therapist?
I have been working with you two for a long time. I know the answer to that one. You do not need a referral.
That is correct. In all 50 states, there is some form of what we call direct access, but it varies state by state. So you need to check with your physical therapist to see what kind of direct access is allowed. And even though direct access is allowed by law, your insurance may think otherwise, right, Lori?
That is correct. So it's always good to check with your insurance provider to make sure that you can be seen without a physician referral. And there are many variations of that. And some places you can be seen by a physical therapist and be evaluated, but you cannot initiate the rehabilitation until a physician signs off on the plan of care. So there's all kinds of variations of that.
Options or
variations
is probably the better way to put it.
Right. So you should check with your third-party payer.
Right. Okay, Larry, Can you just list a few environments where you think physical therapists typically work? Just give me a couple.
Okay. Well, hospitals, sports teams, for sure. Health clubs?
Sure. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
There's many places that physical therapists work, some that are a little bit unconventional or things we don't think about. School districts actually employ physical therapists as well as occupational therapists, speech-language pathologists to work with kids. Lori, you have some other ones?
Nursing homes.
Oh, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, yeah, those swing
facilities.
Pretty
broad range, then. Mm-hmm.
Industrial facilities.
Yeah, that was what I had in my head when I mentioned businesses.
Right, and not just sports, but also performing arts. So there are physical therapists who work with, for example, dance companies.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so they work in a broad range. So there's a large cohort of physical therapists that work in the military.
Yes.
Of course.
Yeah. Yep,
makes sense.
Yep,
and the
VA
place.
System as well. So,
and you don't have to be military to work in those environments.
Correct.
So a lot of them are civilians who work in those systems.
Right.
So.
Right. And along the same line of sort of the military and the industrial is you have people who work with, for example, firefighters and police departments to make sure that they're healthy and safe and help train them as well as work in rehabilitation.
Those are called, we think of that category as what we call the tactical athlete.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, Lori, this one's for you.
Oh, for me? Oh,
yes.
For goodness sake.
Primarily because you're an educator. So how has education of the physical therapist over the years changed?
Well, you know, we don't need to go back as far back as the restoration aids. But when I went to physical therapy school, it was a bachelor's degree. So people went, there were also certificate programs that you could go and get a certificate in physical therapy. When I went to school, it was a bachelor's degree. Mm-hmm. So I obtained a bachelor's degree. Subsequent to that, partly because of the explosion of the amount of information out there that the physical therapist needed to know in order to treat their patients, it progressed to a master's degree. So students would go and earn a bachelor's degree and then go on and get a master's degree, or it would all roll into one. And then eventually it is now an entry-level doctorate program. So it's a doctor of physical therapy, a DPT degree. And again, that's partly in response to just the quantity of information that physical therapists need to have, as well as the fact that we're providing direct access. So we have people who come in with, potentially conditions that are not necessarily musculoskeletal, and the physical therapist needs to be able to identify those, we call them red flags or yellow flags, that suggest that the person who comes in, for example, with low back pain, that there may be some other cause for that low back pain besides a musculoskeletal condition.
So there's been a lot of changes in education over the years of physical therapists. All right, last question. Lori, I'll ask you this. How do physical therapist and physical therapist assistants work together? So you may see a PT when you go into a clinic, or you may experience services with a physical therapist assistant as well.
Correct. So the physical therapist is required by law to do the initial evaluation and to determine the plan of care, including the goals and interventions that are going to be utilized to achieve those goals. And then some of that care may be provided by a physical therapist assistant under the plan of care that was established by the physical therapist. So you may see both of those people throughout your plan of care.
And just like other states' laws, how a physical therapist and physical therapist assistant can work together varies state by state. For example, in the state of Wisconsin, because we have so much rural care, they don't actually need to be in the same facility, but they need to have some communication, face-to-face interactions every so often. So it's very important that the physical therapist who is supervising or working with a physical therapist assistant knows exactly how those rules and regulations work together to really provide optimal care.
And that brings to mind the tele-rehab business in physical therapists. So over a live video call, between the patient and the physical therapist.
Right.
How effective is that?
Well, that's a really good question. So it depends, like most things in medicine, is it depends. Telerehab became very popular during the pandemic when people really needed services but did not feel comfortable coming in face-to-face. So there's a couple different angles to think about telerehab. One is when you see your provider through a video call and you have an assessment or a follow-up visit. We also prescribe home exercise programs digitally. So in terms of the provider and the patient having this Zoom call to initiate or have a follow-up, for physical therapists, it's best to do that initial assessment face-to-face. I mean, truly, because you need to put your hands on a patient. You need to move them. You need to see them. You need to do that. So telerehab doesn't work very well for the initial visit. However, for a follow-up visit, a check-in to say, how are you doing? Are you having trouble with any of your home exercises? Can I see how you're doing it, et cetera? Those work for those occasional spot checks.
Well, you know, if you're 60 miles away from the nearest and let's say you got a bad back.
Right, exactly.
Get in the car and drive 60 miles isn't going to do you much good. After that first time, I could see a lot of value in that.
Right, exactly. And then going on to talk about how that home exercise program is prescribed to that patient, there was some research looking at, hey, are patients more adherent with their home exercise program when it's given to them in a digital format? Mm-hmm. And we often do that. We will give them a link to a website where they can go and they can see a little video of all their exercises that they're supposed to do. So there's research looking at, hey, are people more adherent to their program when they use that versus being handed a piece of paper? And the literature at this point is unclear. So and I think some of it has to do with the complexity of exercise instruction, in that it's much more how the patient is educated in the process. So you can give somebody a paper home exercise program, but if you walk through those exercises with them and you're clear about this is how you do it, that's how you do it, you make notes, that could be as effective as giving a digital home exercise program where the exercises are demonstrated by somebody else and the instructions aren't exactly how you want that patient to do them. So there's a lot of nuance in home exercise prescription that you may not pick up.
Pretty cool stuff, though, for sure.
Yeah.
Bernadette in Dodgeville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bernadette.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had physical therapy on my shoulders, a lot of pain and restrictive movement, and it did help. But I was, it's there's still a lot of pain and restrictive movement. I was wondering, the ultrasound they did seemed to really help. And is there anything that I can purchase for at home use to give myself that kind of deep heat? Or what I could do to, you know.
Yeah.
It really cracks a lot, pops a lot of pain. So, anything?
Right. So, as you said, Bernadette, ultrasound, if they did the thermal effect, is a very, very deep form of heat that can kind of heat up the soft tissues around the joint. And once they're heated up, it probably increased your mobility a bit, maybe made it better for you to stretch and things like that. Probably the best internal heat we have is probably exercising your shoulder or some movement. So perhaps doing some movement through a pain-free range, lower in the range of motion, to get the blood flow circulating in that area prior to doing a bunch of stretching through a new range would probably be the best thing. Maybe a warm shower or heating pad, but that's all going to be superficial.
It's all superficial. Yeah. So I'm not, you know, unfortunately, there is not a lot of evidence that suggests that people have better outcomes with the use of ultrasound. So we use it occasionally, but we don't actually use ultrasound a lot. We find that the best evidence suggests that for people with either limited mobility, or pain, that exercise is really what's going to get them better in the long run. So if you still have limited motion, it might be worthwhile to investigate why you're still having problems. It sounds like you didn't achieve your physical therapy goals with that plan of care. So I would go back or seek the services of a different physical therapist who might take a different approach to your problem. But
right.
There's no commercial ultrasound that you can buy yourself. Because you can actually burn yourself
right.
with that if you're not trained how to use that properly.
Hmm. There you go, Bernadette. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Lori Tyne Brody, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum, our guest today. If you have a physical therapy question, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trita LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at all kinds of physical therapy issues relating to aches and pains and sprains and strains as we visit with our two guests, Jill Tyne Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne Brody. Feel free to join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. Lance in Port Washington called. Couldn't stay with us. A year ago, he broke his foot. Now it's going numb. And at times, he experiences more pain. And he's wondering if physical therapists could help in his situation. That's probably hard to figure out, but what do you think, Jill?
Well, for sure. If he had some sort of fracture and was immobilized, which I'm sure he probably was, or if the fracture was pinned or something like that, Lance would definitely need post-operative or post-conservative, post-immobilization rehabilitation. So there are many, many, many bones in the foot. So depending on which bone Lance actually fractured would definitely impact his rehabilitation. But regardless, I think we could make a blanket statement and say that he would be a candidate for foot rehabilitation, Lori.
Yeah, absolutely. A physical therapist could look at the mechanics of his foot to see if there's a nerve getting pinched mm-hmm. somewhere, again, depending upon where his fracture was, and depending upon how he fractured it, the numbness or those neurologic symptoms could be coming from someplace else in his leg. So it's important to look at the whole, we call it the kinetic chain, and see what might be the source of that. So I think certainly a physical therapist would be a good next step for him to assess why that's beginning to happen and why he's still having pain.
Right, and you don't want him limping. The other thing is he could be limping, and then we could be affecting, as you said, the kinetic chain. He could be affecting his knee, his hip, his back,
yeah.
and then you're
yeah.
just, so it could be, there could be
yeah.
lots of problems associated with this.
Yeah, that's, I saw somebody before I came here who had a knee injury and can't fully straighten the knee
mm-hmm.
and now has come in with not only knee pain, but hip, buttock, and low back pain.
Right, exactly.
Because this person's been walking on a flexed knee since May.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Marlene in Wales has a question for you. Let's go there. Marlene, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I've been following a physical therapy program at home. I had a number of visits with the physical therapy in the office. And I'm wondering, I still get pain. It's from a pinched nerve between two vertebrae, I guess. And I'm just wondering how a chiropractor could enhance the effects of the physical therapy, which is very beneficial, by the way.
So where is this pinched nerve? Is it in your neck or is it in your low back?
Between the L4 and L5
All right.
vertebrae.
L4, L5. Mm-hmm. And tell me about your symptoms now. Do you have any symptoms down into your leg, Marlene? Are they mostly in your back?
And ironically, there's virtually nothing in my back. It's all in one of my legs and in the hips.
Okay. So, because the question is always becomes, is a high-velocity thrust contraindicated, and there is some concern about doing it when there's some sort of space occupying mass, lesion, which can be a herniated disc could be considered that.
Right.
So, you know, did your physical therapist do any joint mobilizations in that area, Marlene?
No.
Okay. You know,
and the term herniated disc has never been used.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. So there are a number of sources of those symptoms down your leg from your back, like at L4, L5. So, you know, it's a fairly narrow opening for that nerve root, and it can be encroached upon by a disc herniation or by some facet degenerative disease. So, you know, the physical therapy program seems to be working. I would hope that you are continuing to see that physical therapist, because if you're still having symptoms in your leg, you're not done. So the first step typically in this kind of situation is to get the symptoms out of your leg and centralized into your back. We want to get rid of those symptoms in your leg.
Yeah, I think going back and seeing the physical therapist, and maybe the physical therapist needs to try some manual therapy, maybe not a high velocity thrust, but try some getting their hands on you, Marlene, and doing some manual therapy, perhaps to see if that helps your symptoms centralize.
Right.
That would probably be my first step.
And then depending upon the chiropractor, there are some chiropractors who do high velocity, which may or may not be indicated, but there are also chiropractors who do very gentle mobilization, which may work. So it's not a yes or no chiropractic is indicated or not indicated, but it's the right treatment at the right time.
Right.
So,
so it's a hard question to answer.
It is. It's a difficult question to
answer.
But
a good one, but a great question.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I would probably start with the physical therapist, because that person knows you and knows your back and has observed your response to the things you've been given thus far.
Is it my imagination, or it seems to me that when you ask that question on this show, L4 and L5
it's a bad design.
Always the two that seem to pop up.
L4, L5, and L5 in the sacrum, S1. Yeah. Those are the big ones. Yep. That's job security for physical therapists. Right. It is a poor design.
It's a poor design. Mm. I mean, basically, that's what it boils down to. You have a lot of load that's carried there. And because so many people are weak, they're not necessarily weak in their lower abdominal muscles, but they don't use their lower abdominal muscles to support that portion of their low back. So that part of your back gets loaded a lot. And if you think about how that part of your low back is curved, you get this sort of constant pressure of those vertebrae sliding forward, which excessively loads your little facet joints, which wears them out just like your knees wear out and cause symptoms. So it has to do with the mechanical design, which is less than optimal, and the poor condition of many people's lower abdominal muscles. Mm.
So there's a really interesting study that was done many years ago, and they found that people with low back pain would start to move and then tighten their abdominal muscles, reactive, and people without low back pain would stabilize using the right abdominal muscles and then move. So it's not only do you have that strength that Lori alluded to, but the timing of how you use those muscles is really important. And that's something that a physical therapist can work with you.
Right. On. What I often see is that people, when you put your hands on them and you say, all right, push against me, that many times those people have good strength in those muscles. But as Jill said, they don't use it, or they don't use it at the right time. Mm-hmm. So we spend a lot of time working on that timing and on that engaging, asking, are you engaging those muscles? And sometimes people say yes, but I can tell from how they're moving that they're not.
Right.
So people don't know that
they don't know
not
how to
using,
do it.
They don't know how to do it.
Well, and it's so cognitive at first. Mm-hmm. It's such a, I have to think about it to make sure that I have the right muscles on, that people can't dual task. You can't do that and walk. It's like walking and chewing gum.
Right.
They can't do it yet because it's not automatic. So that's something that a physical therapist can also help them learn.
Right.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Marlene, thanks again. Richard in Madison, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Hi. I'm happy to be hearing you both on there. Anyway, I've got some pain in on the ball of my right foot that I think could be Morton's neuroma. I've seen a podiatrist. He put some wedges in my shoes that I've been using for probably 3 weeks to a month and haven't had much help. I'm wondering if there's any physical therapy kind of things. I try to walk a couple miles a day, although I haven't been recently because of the pain. So I'm wondering if there are any exercises I can do to strengthen that area of my foot or take load off of it, or I'm not sure what. So
yeah.
What do you think?
So did the podiatrist think that this was a Morton's neuroma and design a wedge specifically for that?
He thought that it could be, but he designed a wedge, I think, for the bursa and thought he would take more conservative approach first, and then if that didn't work, possibly have an ultrasound done and possibly a steroid injection.
So where is the, what toes is that pain between? Can you tell us?
Yes, it is between, let's see, there's my big toe.
This little piggy.
This little piggy, that's right.
That's right.
So big toe is one.
Big toe is one.
Uh-huh, then two.
So it's between two and three.
Yeah, that's probably a Morton's neuroma.
Yeah, exactly.
So
the support he gave you, did it go under the ball of your foot? Like, is that where is it an arch, kind of a pad, a teardrop-shaped pad that goes under, like, the ball of your foot, Richard?
I wear these, they're running shoes, and so they've got an insert in them already. So he put it on the bottom of the insert.
Oh.
Where it's kind of like a wedge that's stuck on there. And then there's a hole that is, or a U-shape that's cut into there where my second and third toe kind of get pressure.
Okay. So, So first of all, if you have a potential Morton's neuroma, you need a shoe with a wide toe box. And putting an insert into a shoe that already has a footbed in it further decreases the space.
Right.
So most of the time when you put an insert in, the other should come out. So, Jill, you wanted to say something.
Well, I
definitely
think, Richard, it sounds like you've done some things to help this Morton's neuroma, and I think seeing a physical therapist is a great idea. Because the question always is, as Lori always gets to, is why? Why only one foot, not the other? You walk a couple miles a day, so that should be fairly symmetrical. So seeing a physical therapist to see if there are other contributing factors to this, how you push off. Maybe he has a really tight gastroc and he goes into early plantar flexion. There are other things that could be contributing to this. So as you asked if there were certain exercises you could do, I definitely think there is, but I think it requires the skills of a physical therapist to design that program.
Right. And to look at the insert that you have and see if there's another alternative.
Your
so
shoes.
Be sure to bring your shoe with that insert in.
Mm. And I just noticed there's a kind of an increase in interest among golfers in not the pointed shoes.
Oh,
now that they're going to a more square.
Wider toe box. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it has to do with that or if it has to do with just getting more torque on your...
Yeah, I wonder if when you rotate your feet a little bit, if you rotate in your shoes and you want a wider toe box, that's a really good question. I should ask my husband who practiced 18 times yesterday.
Only 18? I'm sure there were more swings than that.
There were. He played 18 holes. Yes, there were many, many, many more swings.
Right, well, exactly.
And, of course, right after I had spent a considerable amount of money on a new pair of shoes.
Oh, dear.
Then I saw those and thinking, oh, yeah, of course.
So any shoe that has a pointy toe, and I think of cowboy boots as the classic, that your feet were not designed like that. Look at your foot. Mm-hmm. It's not designed to come to a point, and it completely changes the mechanics of how you load your feet and creates all kinds of problems.
Yeah.
Richard, thanks again for calling. Let's go to Charles in Verona. Charles, hi.
Hi, Larry. This isn't a medical question. I'm just wondering if they have any idea what the cost benefit is of going from a bachelor degree to a doctorate degree.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you want out of your life.
Well, there are no more bachelor programs in existence. So I believe there are no more masters either. Are there,
yeah,
Lori? We're in the process of transitioning?
I don't even know if there are any.
So it's a great question, Charles. You bring up an excellent question. And we did see a salary increase when the degrees went up. However, we also saw a significant increase in tuition because the programs became longer. And it's really interesting you bring this up. There's a lot of, I don't want to say chatter, I want to say research, I guess, looking into the cost-benefit ratio and if we made these physical therapy programs too long, too expensive, and that salaries are not currently reflective of the cost it takes to go to physical therapy school. So there are some schools who are actually decreasing the length of their program, kind of condensing things a little bit. There are also some hybrid models out there that are designed to allow students to work a little bit more while they're in school. There's a couple programs where you do everything asynchronously at home for 3 weeks, where you can continue to work and you watch all of your lectures asynchronously on your own and you do that work. And then 1 week out of a month, you have a week-long face-to-face intensives to learn the psychomotor skills that are required in the program. And those model programs are kind of designed to help defray some of the costs of higher education. So I think ultimately, I think what, as an association, we realized is we need to get this content out to physical therapists because we are much more autonomous. We practice on our own. We're face-to-face. We have direct access. Lori is a direct access provider to make sure that we can make thoughtful clinical decisions. But at the same time, we have to be really mindful of the cost of higher education.
So you graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Do you then go and get a bachelor's degree in something and then move on to, say, biology or something of that nature?
That is probably the most common option is you get a four-year degree and then you go on to physical therapy school. There are some programs. Marquette is one. It's a direct admit, where it's a six-year program. You go all the way straight through. Somewhere along the way, you get a bachelor's, and then you finish with your DPT. So there are some programs that are, what do you call those, Lori?
Direct admit. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I taught at Ithaca College for a few years, and Ithaca College was a direct admit. You came in as a freshman. And we tend to see that a lot in the private schools where you come directly in. So, you know, the cost-benefit, it's... I guess when I would say the benefit, I would say the benefit is to the patients.
Right.
Because there is so much information. I mean, I've taught at UW with Jill. I taught at Ithaca College. I teach at a university in Utah. And the quantity of information that these students need. I mean, just talking about the explosion of information and research in medicine in general and having physical therapists who can look at that evidence and discern sort of fact from fiction or know how to apply that is increasingly important. So, you know, I think back on the education that I got, and it's a fraction of what people have now. But you also need the clinical practice.
Right.
I mean, that's where people really learn, where they have a framework in which they can put this information. So I like the model where students are having a lot of clinic time in parallel with their didactic education.
Interesting. Charles, thanks. That was a great question.
Yep.
They're all good questions.
Yeah.
Ruth in Chippewa Falls, what's on your mind?
Hello. I was told that you could not, you should not wear the weights around your ankles when you walk, and I was just wondering why.
So that's a great question, and as a general rule, I would agree with that. It puts a lot of torque on other joints. So it puts a lot of torque on how you use, let's say, your quadriceps at your knee joint to kind of swing your leg through. So it puts a lot of torque that is unnecessary on other joints. I think if you wanted to increase your resistance while you were walking to kind of increase your heart rate, things like that, I would I would maybe hold mm-hmm. weights instead.
Yep, I would go
as long as you're not hypermobile.
Right, exactly. The other thing that happens with ankle weights is you increase what we call your ground reaction force, and that's the amount of load you hit the ground with. And that reverberates through your joints. So if you want your legs to be stronger, I would do leg strengthening exercises. I would not add ankle weights to my walking.
There you go, Ruth. Thank you so much. Susan sent an email. She has an occasional pain under one kneecap, only on steep, uneven hiking. Should she see her physician first or a physical therapist directly?
Well, if her insurance allows her to see a direct access of a physical therapist, that would probably be a very good way to go. This sounds very musculoskeletal in nature. It sounds like Susan's very active if she's out hiking. So it sounds like it's probably a fairly common patellofemoral MSK condition that a physical therapist could see. If it was something unusual, then the PT would refer it on.
Yeah, exactly.
Tom in Racine emailed, his wife began experiencing severe shoulder pain and restricted motion following COVID and flu shots.
Oh.
Is there a correlation in treatment? I just got my fourth COVID shot. I had pain in my shoulder for 2 days, probably.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we can associate it necessarily with the flu shot or COVID, but I think what probably is happening, my best guess is that Tom's wife immobilized her arm for a few days because her arm was painful. And depending on her age, she may be in an age range where she's at risk for a frozen shoulder. Is that what you're thinking, Laura?
Yeah, it sounds like a frozen shoulder. And, you know, I've heard people say that they got a shot in their arm and then they had shoulder pain and on and on. So it's hard to know. There's not a large body of evidence that points to various vaccinations resulting in shoulder pain. But it may be that she was, as Jill said, just in that right age group at the right time where she's developed a frozen shoulder. So I would get her in to mm-hmm. see somebody right away, particularly, you know, for a long time we treated frozen shoulders in physical therapy. They take a long time to recover. But we're finding that if you get in early and you do a cortisone injection into the joint, these people recover a lot faster.
Right.
So I would have Susan get in to see her physician to start with and get a good look at that. And if she's got a frozen shoulder, get her on that track to get it injected.
And I've always been told to swing my arm around after a shot and, you know, make sure you use that arm.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's the last time I got mine, I got my COVID booster maybe a month ago. And I was going to get it in my non-dominant arm. And they said, oh, no, get it in your dominant arm because that's the one you're going to use the rest of the day.
That's a great
point.
And pun intended.
She was right. That's right. Exactly. So I went out and I mowed the lawn and pushed and pulled that lawnmower with that arm. And I had no pain.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to use it.
I did it in my non-dominant arm. I move, but not as nearly as much as I would have moved
my
right
arm. That's very interesting. Yeah, I'll have to think about that. I got my flu shot, but I need to get my COVID booster, and I'm going to have them put it in my dominant arm.
Yeah.
Do it.
Yeah.
There you go. A tip from Jill and Lori. Jill Tai-Nissenbaum, associate professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy program at UW, and Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Open lines get you on pretty quickly. The number to call with your question or comment is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at physical therapy on the program today with Jill Tai-Nissenbaum and Lori Tyne-Brody. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining in today. We had an email from Scott in Stevens Point. He's currently rehabbing a torn Achilles tendon and does physical therapy at a location in his small town. His insurance company only allows so many visits, so they have to spread them out a bit. This online rehab thing is very interesting to Scott because he always goes back to his physical therapist a couple of weeks later and realizes that his form is slightly off in some way or another, and it's affecting his recovery. Not sure if you covered this or not, and we didn't, but can a patient submit video of himself or herself during the workout so that a therapist can point out a foot or hip or some other thing that's slightly wrong or pointed in the wrong direction?
Great question. It depends upon their electronic medical record system, whether or not you can upload a video to a provider. Sometimes it's only one way. And, you know, in terms of the video stuff, what I prefer in a perfect world is rather than my going to some third-party vendor and giving you exercises that the third-party vendor has put together, I like when the patient brings their phone and I can videotape the patient doing the exercise and hearing me tell them what are the things you should or shouldn't be doing during that exercise. Then you go home and you've got a video of yourself doing the exercise the way your physical therapist wants you to do it. So in terms of Scott's question, he would need to contact his provider to see if he could send them a video of him doing the exercises. Otherwise, the next time he goes in, take his phone along and have the therapist video him doing the exercises.
Or the other option is what we have is people will say, well, you know, my pain comes on when I run on the treadmill after 10 minutes. And so they'll record the first minute of their running, and then they'll record at minute 10 when they're running, and they just bring their phone in and let us look at it there. This is what happened when I exercised yesterday. So that's another option that Scott would have. The other thing about putting people's home exercise program on their own phone is fantastic. It's a really good idea. Just understand that as physical therapists, we make sure there's no other patients in the background for HIPAA purposes.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So it may mean we pull you in a room, pull the curtain, things like that, but that's all for HIPAA.
Right.
Okay. Andy in Lac des Flambeaux, your turn. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I was treated for plantar fasciitis a year ago in my left foot, and the doctor gave me orthotic inserts, which I used, and my plantar fasciitis was ameliorated, and that was a year ago. She told me to keep the orthotics forever in all my shoes, so that's what I was doing, but then my knees started aching as when I walked the dog, and it was worse and worse and worse, and I ended up just taking out the orthotics, and I noticed some immediate improvement. They're not cured, but there was an immediate improvement. Is there any relationship between orthotic use and possible knee pain?
Well, there definitely could be. It could be completely how it's changing your load. So if the orthotics were designed to kind of offload your arch a little bit or change your heel height, that load could definitely get sent up the chain to the knee. The other thing you need to consider with orthotics as a general rule is they do have a shelf life. And I think this is something that people forget about. You know, we replace our shoes, but we don't replace our orthotics. And so I believe, Lori, I'm looking at you, is running shoes, it's 400 miles. Do you know what the shelf life, the life expectancy of a pair of orthotics is if you wear them every day?
No, I expect it has to do with miles, the same thing. And because you're not running but walking, it probably extends it a bit more.
Yeah.
But I think it also has to do with body weight and gait.
Sure.
I don't think there's a standard. So how long after you got your orthotics did your knee start to hurt?
Probably a month.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so I was going to say if it was, you know, 10 months later, then maybe your knees liked the orthotics and then your orthotic is breaking down. But if it was only a month, then your knees didn't like the orthotic so much or how it changed your loading pattern. So again, it would be useful to see a physical therapist who can look at your gait mechanics, who can look at the alignment of your lower extremities to see if there is a different orthotic.
Right.
That would work for you. So now that you've taken the orthotics out, how's your plantar fasciitis?
It's fine. I have no symptoms at all.
All right. I Right. Very good. So I would go see the physical therapist and one or two visits and have them look at your mechanics, maybe give you some things to stretch and strengthen your plantar fascia so that it doesn't come back, to try to figure out why you only had symptoms in one foot and not the other, and to understand why your knee didn't like that orthotic. So if you needed an orthotic in the future, what kind of characteristics of that orthotic you should look for, because they're not all the same.
Take the orthotic with him.
For sure. And the shoes and everything. Yep.
Okay. Absolutely.
Good luck, Andy. Yeah. Thank you. Tiffany in Sheboygan, your turn. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, I have a question about my son who likes to sit with his legs kind of like a W shape.
Oh, yeah.
How long is that bad for? You know, he's pretty active. He only sits for a couple minutes, but should I be trying to get him to change his leg position?
How old is he?
2.
Oh,
nah.
It's fine.
No, I wouldn't worry about it.
Right. You're
okay.
Because the reason we asked about age is because we're thinking about bone stabilization, have all of the growth plates fused, things like that. And he's still pretty, I mean, in the nicest way, a cartilaginous blob.
Yeah.
So exactly. he's still pretty pliable.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's a big deal at all.
As long as he's sitting in a variety of positions, you know, crisscross applesauce and other positions, and isn't always defaulting to this one position. You want, as children are growing and forming and their bones are strengthening, you want to have a variety of inputs so that they develop in a way that they're going to be used across your lifetime. You don't want any single kind of position.
Right.
There you go, Tiffany. Thank you. Rick in Northeast Iowa. Hello. Thanks for calling.
How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call.
Yep. I had my left hip replaced in the end of July of last year. And ever since then, I've had a tingling above my knee all the way to the tip of my toes that never goes away 24/7. And also where my incision was, where they replaced my hip, that is sore to the touch all the time. And now they want me to do a EMG and, you know, get that checked out to see what's going on there. I've heard different things about an EMG, like, you know, it's kind of painful and stuff.
Kind of?
You think?
I mean, I have no idea, but is it?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Yes.
I haven't heard anyone say that it was a walk in the park, that it was pleasant, or that they were looking forward to it. No, basically, they stick needles in along the course of a nerve, and then they send an electric current through there to see if the nerves are working like they're supposed to. So they want to find the origin of this. Have they done any other testing yet, Rick, or is this their first go-to?
No, this is the first go-to.
You know, that's probably not where I'd start. What about you, Jill? You just kind of shook your head, too.
Well, so you mentioned it was numbness and tingling. Do you have any weakness in your leg down that side of your leg?
Well, you know, I got a pretty good limp.
Oh, that's probably why then. Yeah. So they're looking for if it's not only numbness and tingling, it's weakening. Do you think your limp is coming where do you think your limp is coming from? Is it coming from your hip and the total hip, or do you think it's coming from this thing down on the lateral side of your leg?
Well, the hip and everything down that leg. Okay. I mean, when they suggested that I get a hip replacement, I thought, yeah, I know my hip hurts and stuff, but it is worse now than it was before I had the surgery.
Yeah. Okay. So, I guess, you know, Jill and I are sort of in concurrence here that we're wondering if it's coming from your back, and I might start with an MRI of your lumbar spine first. Because if you're not any better after your hip replacement, so people who get a hip replacement, they're happy campers. They're dancing in the streets.
They are happy campers.
So it relieves their hip pain. Most of them recover very nicely. If you're having the same symptoms or worse pain than before your hip replacement, and given the description of your symptoms, I would look at an MRI of the lumbar spine first,
yeah,
and take a look at that and see if that explains your symptoms. And then if everything looks hunky-dory there, then you might go for the EMG as a next step.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
There you go, Rick. Thank you so much for calling, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW-Madison. One of our guests, the other, Lori Tyne-Brody, physical therapist and athletic trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. And they are going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, so still time for you to call in. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. We'll take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Lori and Jill. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking physical therapy with Jill Tyne-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program at UW, and Lori Tyne-Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. Our lines are all filled right now, and we've got some emails, too, so let's get right to the phones here and talk with Andrew in Milwaukee. Andrew, thanks for calling.
Hi, I'm here. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I was diagnosed about 2 to 2.5 years ago with myasthenia gravis, and it seems to be affecting my neck mostly. And I was just wondering what kind of physical therapy might be advisable. And I have one exercise I do for neck strengthening, which I actually was doing before this diagnosis. So I'm just interested in what you might have to suggest.
So why do you think that the myasthenia gravis is affecting your neck?
Well, I just feel it's getting stiffer, and it's when I walk, it is affected in a way it didn't used to be. And, you know, when I was diagnosed, and I've seen some,
PTs.
So first, yeah. Maybe, Laura, you could explain what that condition is.
Well, it's a neurologic condition that results in some weakness, typically weakness throughout the body, and it tends to come and go. There are times when it's worse and times when it's a little better. Andrew, because you were having symptoms prior to your diagnosis, it makes me think that you had an underlying condition in your neck, and maybe layering the myasthenia gravis on top of an existing condition has really amplified your symptoms there. So it sounds like you've seen a neurologic physical therapist. And as Jill and I said at the top of the show, when we talk about where physical therapists work, she and I work primarily in musculoskeletal PT, but there are physical therapists who work primarily with neurologic cases. And that's where I would classify this. So there's probably some overlap between musculoskeletal and neurologic, but I think the neurologic physical therapist would be the way to go.
I do, and I agree that the weakness is definitely something that's probably impacting this. So I don't think one exercise is probably enough. I'm guessing you have multiple impairments. There may be mobility impairments, and there may be weakness in multiple muscles. So I'm glad you're doing an exercise, but I think you need a little bit more comprehensive rehabilitation program for this. So I'd probably go back and see the neuro PT and get on a more comprehensive rehab program for this.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. That's where I would stay, because the myasthenia gravis is going to override the musculoskeletal piece of it at this point.
Yeah.
Good luck, Andrew. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Grand Chute, we go to you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm a 75-year-old jogger who's jogged his whole life. And I had a soft fall on my bicycle about 6 weeks ago, and I've had back pain from my my buttocks that runs down through to my calf, and it tightens up. The pain isn't severe, but it tingles. And I've been able to I take a leave, and that seems to solve some of the problems, and I've been using heat, but it isn't going away. I can ride my bicycle 10 to 12 miles a day, but I can't walk comfortably any distance, and running is out of the question.
Okay.
Where should I start?
It's time to see a physical therapist. It's time. So you've tried some self-treatment, and you made some good choices, mm-hmm. some anti-inflammatories, some heat, things like that. You're pretty active as a 75-year-old right. jogger. We don't want to stop that. So it's time to see a physical therapist. My guess is maybe you stirred something up in your lumbar spine, in your back. So biking would be probably a little more flexion.
Yeah, it could be, or you could have, depending upon where you landed when you had your little bike accident, it could be in your buttocks, like in your piriformis. Yeah. So seeing a physical therapist to sort out the source of the symptoms, is it coming from your back or is it coming primarily from your buttock? And then directing the rehabilitation there. If you are able to still bike comfortably, absolutely do that. That's like peripheral aerobics. It increases yep. the circulation to those tissues and will help with healing. So I would absolutely continue that. I would experiment with your walking, taking a smaller step, a shorter stride, and see if that changes anything. But I would get in to see a physical therapist. We need to get you back out doing the things that you like to do.
For sure.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Nick in Green Bay, we'll go to you next. Hi, Nick.
Hey, guys. I just wanted to call in and thank you guys big time. You three are my heroes. I called in about 4 months ago. I had just got my TBI, traumatic brain injury, and I was in a pretty dark place. Holy God. And you guys took me off the air. You referred me to Neuroscience Group in Appleton. And that was, like, life-changing. Like, I'm in speech therapy. I'm in vision therapy. I mean, life still sucks, but it sucks a lot less.
I remember this. You were in a car accident, right? Is that right?
I was actually unloading a window at the stadium, and I just got placed in my job. I took the step off the back of the semi, and that's the last thing I remember for 3 days.
That's right. Can you just tell us briefly, Nick, about the vision therapy and kind of some of the therapies you're doing and how that's positively impacting you? I'm just curious for our listeners.
Positively, I don't know about that, but because I get headaches, and I go down there, and they have this string, and they have beads on there.
It's a Brock string, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then they have pictures that I got to work on. And my problem is my eyes don't work together. They work independently, I guess. And then on the physical therapy, she said, and you might know this more than, I don't know what I'm talking about, but I got crystals behind my eyes that should be in my ears.
Oh.
But,
BPPV.
Yeah, but you guys.
Oh, right.
Yeah, well, I'm wondering if that's
you
right.
You guys are my heroes. You're my angels.
I'm so glad that you found people who are helping you. You know, there are people out there. And again, when we talked at the top of the show, we do musculoskeletal. But this area that Nick is talking about, again, is a very specialized area that physical therapists work in. So,
yeah.
And your rehab doesn't work unless you do it. So hats off to you for doing it and kind of digging yourself out of this hole, which was, I remember you were in a very dark place. So congratulations.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Way to go,
fantastic.
Nick.
Keep working hard.
Yeah, yeah.
And where did you send him?
There was a facility we found down by Appleton that worked with neurocognition, neurocognitive.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I can't remember all the details, but I do remember having an email exchange, the three of us had an email exchange.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Nick, for calling.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
We'd love to hear that.
That made my day.
Nancy in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I'm a Caucasian woman, 90 years old. I have been told I have a rather advanced osteoporosis, and my doctor wants me to have a drug called Reclast dripped into my arm. It'll cost me $1,000. And it occurred to me to ask you if you have had experience with people who have osteoporosis and can attest to the fact that these drugs really do stop the osteoclast, osteoblast sequence. And if you know that if Reclast has any advantages that any other earlier drug for this osteoporosis that might now be lesser in cost because it's past the period when it first was put on the market.
Right.
What great questions. My goodness. So I don't know enough about this drug in particular compared to other
previous
osteoporosis drugs, especially the ones you take monthly versus this.
Interesting. Pharmacokinetics are not my expertise. So what I do know is, and it sounds like you're really well informed, so you could probably go into PubMed and research this and find an answer. But sometimes the newer drugs have an advantage in that you don't have to take them as often. You don't have to take them as frequently. They're not filtered through your kidneys, and so you tend to have fewer side effects, and it tends to be not as hard on your kidneys and some of your other systems. Sometimes the results in terms of the strength of your bones or kind of putting a finger in the dam and that you're preventing the decline of your bone strength. So it's not that your bones are getting stronger, but that you're preventing further decline. It may be that the outcomes are no different, but the side effects of the Reclast and the ease of taking it are the benefits. So it would be what we would call a non-inferiority trial.
But if you don't mind, Nancy, if you're willing to leave your phone number, there's a physical therapist in La Crosse that kind of specializes in bone health, Barb. And I would be happy to connect you with Barb, and she may know a little bit more about this. I think she works a little bit more with people with osteoporosis. And if you don't mind leaving that contact information, I could hook you up with her.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. So hang on, Nancy, and we'll get some information.
Thank you, Larry.
Yeah. In the meantime, let's go to Heidi in Waukesha. Heidi, what's on your mind?
Hi. I was recently diagnosed with a large herniated disc at C5 and C6 with encroachment and cord contusion.
Oh.
So now my doctor is referring me to a spine clinic. But before I go, I'm just wondering if there's non-surgical options given that. What they found, because I really don't want to have surgery, and I have no pain. What originally took me in was just lower body incoordination. So initially I was diagnosed with possibly MS, and then it was transverse myelitis, but now they found this on the MRI.
Right, cervical myelopathy. So she's getting pressure on her spinal cord.
Yeah.
So if I were having symptoms in my lower extremity because of pressure on my spinal cord and my neck, I would do whatever anybody told me was the right thing to do. Physical therapists help with disc herniations, most of them that cause peripheral symptoms in your upper extremity. You have a case where you're getting pressure on the spinal cord itself, and that is not something that's amenable to physical therapy. So I would follow up with that consult to spine clinic and get as much information as you can on that.
Right. And they may be able to offer you some other conservative options versus surgery. Typically, they like to hierarchically rank their options from kind of the least conservative to the most aggressive. Mm-hmm. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
Most conservative. Okay.
Uh-huh.
From conservative to aggressive. So
right.
Certainly you can have that conversation with them, but I think that's the right place for you to go, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah.
Good luck. Thank you very much, Heidi. James in Sparta, your turn. Hi, James.
Hey, Larry. I had a couple quick questions for the physical therapists that are online with you right now. I'm in the military, and my job is combat engineer, and I lift a bunch of heavy stuff and ruck and do everything that, you know, the Army tells me to do. I was wondering, because I tore 3 to 4 ligaments in my left hip. I had a procedure done where they gave me a shot in my hip to kind of, I guess, give me some more months for it to heal. But the pain came back, and I'm not sure if I should get surgery because I'm moving to Fort Polk, Louisiana, here in the next 5 weeks. If I should wait on the surgery for till I get down there, or should I just proceed or see if I can get another shot from my provider?
Hmm. Okay, so did the when they did the injection in your hip, did you get relief from it, James? And if so, how long did that relief last?
Probably a month and a half for the relief, ma'am.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like that probably is the driver of his pathology.
Right, right. But what ligaments torn right. in your hip?
Was it labrum?
It's not a very common to tear ligaments.
It was the labrum.
The labrum. Okay, fine.
All right, got it. That's clear.
That's okay. They're two L words. It makes sense.
It is.
So,
he's talking about a labral repair.
Correct. And did they say if you had any bony changes or anything like that in your hip when they did?
No, they just said it was the ligaments itself. Because I'm only 31 years old. I've been in the Army for 13 years. And, you know, having a torn ligaments in your hip is kind of bad.
Yeah. Right. So the labrum is kind of like the meniscus of your knee.
Correct.
So given that it only lasted a month and a half, that's not very long. And if you're carrying heavy loads, if you're rucking, you know, 80 pounds on your back and such, that hip's not going
to
hold up.
Right. But getting to his point, should I have surgery now or have surgery when I get moved to Louisiana? I don't know that that matters that much.
Right.
It's not urgent. I would have it done within the next couple of months, probably.
Right.
But I don't know that it's impacted if you have
right.
it done prior to your
right.
transfer.
Right.
So you know, should he get a shot then?
I don't think I get a shot.
No, I wouldn't get a shot.
Primarily because a lot of surgeons
won't do surgery
after you've had
after
a
shot.
You have to
for
have a window
months.
Of time. You have to have wait a couple
yep,
months.
Yep. So if you're comfortable with the person that you've met with here and the surgeon who did the original diagnosis and who discussed the surgical plan, if you're more comfortable with that person, then you may want to have it done here. Because you know that system, and I don't know how the military works in terms of that transfer in 5 weeks, if you have surgery or how that all goes. That's something you'd have to work out with the military itself.
Right.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
James, good luck. Appreciate your call. Diane in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Diane.
Hi. My question is regarding a total knee replacement I had done 4 months ago. And I have a slight impingement yet. I can't quite get it past 115 for my mobility. And I seem to walk pretty good. Sometimes I have a little hitch in it yet. But at night I still have pain where I need to take acetaminophen. The doctor has mentioned that if it's not better by this week that he would take me in maybe and crack those adhesions. Is that something you would advise or know what he's talking about?
Can you fully straighten your knee?
Yeah.
Boy, 115 is awfully close.
Yeah.
115 is, I mean, we like to get you to 120, but honestly, there's
five degrees
of measurement
of error.
Yeah. There's 5 degrees of measurement error at the knee. So, you know, I always wonder, like, if you go in and you manipulate that, there's always a possibility you're going to lose motion,
right,
too.
Exactly, because you kick off this inflammatory response cycle.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, if you were sitting at 75 or 90,
yeah.
I'd say for sure. But you're so, I don't know, 115 isn't
yeah.
bad at all.
Yeah.
What do you have on your other side? Do you know, Diane? How much flexion?
I presumed 120.
Yeah.
I had that replaced 5 years ago,
oh.
and that one went smoother than this one.
Okay.
This one I've always been a couple weeks behind on.
Yeah. Well, there's no have to's here. If you're already 4 months out, waiting another month isn't going to matter for that knee replacement. I'd continue working. I'd be working hard on some distraction, some traction across that knee joint. to see if you can really stretch some of that stuff and get your motion that way. I'd keep at it.
Good luck, Diane. Thank you. Susan in the UP of Michigan. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I do have to say you guys are so good. I have learned so much from you, and Larry, you too. So thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
So my question is another cortisone shot in the hip question. I'll try to keep it brief. several years ago, I was diagnosed with sacroiliitis. I have severe back spasms, and I have been doing back exercises and stretches, trying to strengthen my core, and that does help. And then just about a year ago, my hip started bothering me, and I tried the, you know, anti-inflammatories. I tried rest. I tried exercise. I finally went to the doctor, got a diagnosis of trochanter bursitis.
Yep.
And I went to PT. I've been doing some just the exercises with the band, you know, the sidestepping like strengthening. But nothing really else. Stretches, a couple stretches that really helped. So then I went to an ortho doc, and he confirmed the diagnosis of bursitis, and he gave me a cortisone injection. So that helped. It did. It helped. I'm stable. It's better. It's not, you know, good, but it's better. So I'm convinced that helped along with the stretches. And I have made an appointment for my second cortisone injection November 11. So I'm just kind of wondering, and I'm thinking after listening to you guys, I'm thinking I need to go to a better physical therapist. I'm thinking there's got to be other physical therapies that I can be doing.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, yes, if you're like any other healthcare provider, right. If you're unhappy with the person you're seeing and feel like you're not getting the services that you expect or need, then absolutely find somebody else. One of the things I will say about trochanteric bursitis is it's a tough one. Mm-hmm. It's a tough problem, and it takes a long time to get over it. Eventually, strengthening will help, but as we said earlier in the show, strengthening only works if you use that muscle in your daily activities. So we might find that you're strong in your hip muscles, but the way you walk and move is overloading that bursa. The strengthening here, it's the slow boat. It takes a long time. So you just have to stick with it. So,
yeah. Good luck, Susan. Thank you so much. And big thanks to Jill and Laurie. Thank you so much for being
here. Our pleasure. It was a lot of
great
fun,
Larry.
You'll be back in a month, and we'll do this all over
again. Sounds great.
Perfect. Jill Tine-Nissenbaum, Associate Professor in the Doctor of Physical Therapy Program, and Laurie Tine-Brody, Physical Therapist and Athletic Trainer at UW Health Spine Physical Therapy Clinic. They'll be back in a month, and we'll do it again. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a book chronicling a football game played in the midst of a deadly world war, World War II. Plus, we cover how you can make Halloween just a little healthier this year. That's tomorrow at 11. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.